Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
991 days, 12 hours, 54 minutes, 43 seconds until George W. Bush leaves office voluntarily. Good morning, good afternoon, wherever you may be around. Good evening, if you're in Asia. Welcome to the program. Tom Hartman here with you. Coming up on today's program, Representative Sherrod Brown is here. Currently, he's a congressman in Ohio's 13th district and is running for the United States Senate against Republican Senator Mike DeWine. Our quote for the day from Sir Winston Churchill. "A fanatic," said Churchill, "is one who can't change his mind and won't change the subject." And just a quick update on what's going on in Iraq. Our Iraq overview for the day. Baghdad gunmen killed Mohammed Ridha, a brigadier in the defense ministry in the capital's Yarmouk district, police said. Near Tikrit, gunmen killed an Iraqi soldier on Wednesday. Near Tikrit, 175 kilometers north of Baghdad, said the Joint Coordination Center run by the U.S. and Iraqi militaries. Also in Tikrit, gunmen gunned down a tailor. And in Balad, gunmen killed a civilian on Wednesday. Just 50 miles north of Baghdad, according to the Joint Coordination Center. So our update for the day from Iraq. Our question for the hour, does the retiring Exxon chief, Lee Raymond, deserve a $400 million retirement package? Yaron Brook is with us. He's the executive director of the Ayn Rand Institute, AYNRAND.org. Ayn Rand, of course, the author of Atlas Shrugged and many other tracts and tomes that have become, in many ways, the cornerstone of the modern libertarian and objectivist and many would say the modern conservative movement. Yaron, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on.
So, does Lee Raymond deserve $400 million?
Well, I think it's that's for shareholders to decide, and obviously they decided he does, and I don't see the point or the reason to question their judgment. And indeed, Lee Raymond, for shareholders, has performed extraordinarily. $400 million is a tiny fraction of the wealth he has created for them.
Well, let's flip this around. There are a number of other CEOs whose companies are going down in value, whose shareholders are taking it on the chin, and yet they're paying themselves millions, in some cases tens or hundreds of millions of dollars. Do they equally deserve it?
Well, again, I think the responsibility to make that call is of shareholders. If the companies are going down because of the actions of the CEO, then I'd like to see shareholders empowered to be able to kick those CEOs out. So I would like to see a deregulation of corporate governance to allow more control for shareholders over the fate of CEOs and over the choices of who sits on the board, so that their money, because ultimately CEOs get compensated with money paid to them, CEOs get compensated by money paid to them by shareholders, so that shareholders can better control these packages.
So deregulating the system, let's go back to the days of John D. Rockefeller when he basically said, here's how much money I'm going to pay myself?
Well, that's not what he said, but going back to the days where J.P. Morgan had his people sitting on 100 different boards.
J.P. Morgan was a flaming liberal.
One CEO who was overpaid because what J.P. Morgan made sure is that they performed well, they made money for their shareholders, because otherwise he would lose money.
Right, and later when he came into government, he wanted to make sure the government enforced those same kinds of things. I'm really surprised you're quoting Morgan.
J.P. Morgan was never in government. J.P. Morgan indeed was harassed by government his entire career, and you could argue that the Federal Reserve was created in order to reduce the influence and power of J.P. Morgan.
I must be mixing him up with somebody else.
I think so.
Yeah, I think so. Okay, well, in any case, here's the question, Yaron Brook, Executive Director of the Ayn Rand Institute. Are corporations the modern-day equivalent of kingdoms? And if so, why do we have kingdoms among us? I mean, we have people who are literally living a world apart from all the people around them. They live in a separate world. They don't travel on the same airplanes we do, not even in first class. They have their own private jets. They don't eat in the same places we do. I mean, literally they have carved out a kingdom these princes of these dynasties, these economic royalists, to use Franklin Roosevelt's term, and there's not that many of them. We're talking really about a few thousand people. I mean, there's only 140,000 people in the United States last year who claimed an income of over $5 million. So of over $1 million. This is a relatively small number of people and you know, hundreds of millions of dollars. Why do we allow kingdoms to exist within our country?
Well, because we believe in freedom in this country. Now, I don't think they're kingdoms, but well, we believe in freedom, and therefore if somebody can make $100 million, we leave them alone. We don't try to dictate what people should make, and I think that's good. I think what makes this country great is that we generally try to leave people alone, to live their lives, to do the best that they can.
So if Lee Raymond and the heads of three other oil companies are able to control essentially a monopoly on oil in the United States, it's been a long time. I don't know, maybe something's happening different where you live, but it's been a long time since I've seen a price war among gas stations. Have you seen one recently?
Well, every day there's a price war among gas stations,
no.
Just like every day there's a price war among bread companies. The fact is that when you go into the grocery store, bread of the same type is priced the same no matter who makes it. That's the way the market functions. It's driven to, at that point,
I remember gas wars, Iran. I remember back when there were 30, 40 gas oil companies in this country, and there were gas wars, and there were all these obscure brands, and they, you know, and when, in fact, I remember when Standard Oil's back in the 50s and 60s, when their strategy was wherever there was a successful gas station run by one of their competitors, they'd put one on the opposite corner, and then, you know, drop the price to try and run them out of business.
Sure. So,
and it seems to me like what you're suggesting is that because Lee Raymond was successful in driving a process where the American people were lied to for years about global climate change, and he was the major force behind funding and organizing this whole program to make us think that the scientists think that there's some kind of a debate, and that he's able to, him and his company have been able to control a large chunk of the oil, that we should just say, okay, that's fine. You guys just, you know, take it from us.
Well, I'm not sure where to start there, but let's put global warming aside. Lee Raymond does not control the oil supplies of the United States. Those are held by many different companies in many different countries. Some of them function within the United States. Some of them do not. The oil business, $70 a barrel is not determined by Lee Raymond. It is determined by supply and demand out there in the market. If anybody has lied to the American people, it is our politicians who have consciously restricted the amount of oil available to us by not allowing us to drill in places like Alaska off the shore of California and off the shore of Florida, that have created a foreign policies that has allowed sheiks in the Middle East to control the fate of Americans.
But that foreign policy has been driven by politicians, by corporations led by people like Lee Raymond, who are making huge contributions to politicians saying, look out for our interests. You know, get rid of that Jimmy Carter guy. We don't want the government supporting alternative energy. We'd rather have the government supporting the oil industry with an $8 billion
welfare package. Well, I think the idea of a government supporting alternative energy is a horrible idea, because I think that would guarantee that we won't get alternative energy. We will get alternative energy when oil prices, because of supply and demand, rise, and venture capitalists start investing in alternative energy, which is already happening.
What's wrong with we the people saying?
You can see that in Canada right now, where Canada has reserves of oil shale that are, or sand shale, or whatever they call it, which exceed the reserves of
Saudi Arabia.
Yeah. And now oil is expensive enough to make it economical to start investing in producing that oil. The market works.
But the point is that if you follow that, then you're saying we're going to lurch from crisis to crisis. If you say, okay,
no,
we
we'll
as a society, we're going to...
We'll go through a period of high prices. The market will...
And devastate the lower end of the middle class that has to drive to work, and they're driving a gas guzzler because the government did not have the political will to stand up to Lee Raymond and raise CAFE standards.
But the government should not be responsible for raising any kind of standards. The government's...
What's wrong with us saying we want to define some of these things?
No, because the government every time it tries to do this, like Jimmy Carter did in the 70s and like Richard Nixon tried to do in the 70s, they create distortions and perversions in the market. They create situations in which we at least now don't stand in line in the gas stations like we were in the 70s, which was completely the fault of our politicians, not the fault of OPEC or anybody else.
I agree with you. Richard Nixon's price controls were wrong, and I'm not an advocate of price controls. I'll just put that on the table. But when you suggest that Jimmy Carter, by giving incentives to a solar industry and alternative energy industry, which literally birthed that industry, was making a mistake, I'd say, no, I'm sorry. This is along with things like public transportation. That's the stuff that we should be doing.
It's a waste of our public money. The best thing, you know, public transportation.
Planning for the future is a waste of our money?
Profitable. What's that?
Planning for the future is a waste of our money?
For the government to do it, the government is an awful planner of the future. The best plan, you know, the government, everything that we have around us, or most of the stuff we had around us, was planned for the future by the so-called evil CEOs that you condemn endlessly on the show. They're the ones.
We're talking with Yaron Brook. He's with the Ayn Rand Institute, AYNRAND.org. Yaron, can you stick around?
Absolutely.
Would you like to take some calls from our listeners?
Love to.
Oh, this should be interesting. It's 16 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Our number 1-866-440-8466. We'll be right back.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Twin soldiers and Nixon coming, we're finally on our own. This summer I hear the drumming for dead in Ohio. Gotta get down to it, soldiers are running us down. Should have been done long ago. What if you
can you run when you know? Welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour today, the 36th anniversary of the Kent State Massacre. Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Young, was it? Sometimes I mix up the order there. Four dead in Ohio. 1-866-440-TOM, 440-THOM, our telephone number, tomhartman.com, if you'd like to drop into our live chat room. We have with us Yaron Brook, who is the executive director of the Ayn Rand Institute, AYNRAND.org. We're talking about whether or not Lee Raymond deserves a $400 million retirement package. Should corporations be able to do pretty much whatever they want? Should they be able to influence politics however they want? Are we creating new kingdoms in our country, et cetera, all the variations thereof? You know, what form, ultimately, I'd say, really the issue here is what form of government, what form of marketplace do we want to have in this constitutionally limited Democratic Republic.
Can I make one point?
Please.
And that is that you mentioned what influence corporations should have in politics, and I would love to get to the point where they have zero influence, because politics has zero influence on corporations. The point where there's no regulation, that all the government does is protect us from fraud and protect us from the use of force by corporations, is the point where corporations don't have to lobby Congress because they can't get anything out of Congress.
So then Lee Raymond can go out and hire all kinds of phony scientists to convince us that his product isn't destroying the planet, and the government can and should do absolutely nothing about that.
Well, I happen to think that top scientists from MIT and top climatologists from around the world are not phony scientists, but I don't think we want to get into a discussion of global warming. I think that, sure, Lee Raymond can hire any scientists he wants and pay them, and other people can hire their scientists, and we can have a debate about global warming. I think that's a healthy thing to have, not a bad thing to have.
And for example, the tobacco companies for 40 years denying that their products were harmful, or the asbestos industry that for 50 years covered up the fact that asbestos causes mesothelioma.
There's a big difference between the tobacco company and the asbestos companies. The tobacco companies clearly lied, and that is fraud, and they should be prosecuted for fraud. But
so then you think that the government should interfere in the market?
The government should protect us from fraud, period. But the asbestos companies did not lie to us. The asbestos companies did not know. There's absolutely zero evidence to suggest that the asbestos company knew at any point until the 1980s that there was a problem.
1936,
Yaron. With the product? What's that?
My father's dying from mesothelioma right now. It's asbestos-caused cancer. I'm very knowledgeable about this topic. The first article identifying mesothelioma as a consequence of asbestos exposure was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association in 1936.
And
the
why
industry knew, and those sons of bitches lied to us all those years.
Well, but if it was in the journal, why did nobody do anything? I mean, they didn't suppress the journal. They didn't take it out of circulation.
Nobody talked about it. There was money to be made.
But unions could have talked about it. Doctors could have talked about it.
I don't think the unions knew about it. And this was just a, hey, you know, we're noticing this association. Maybe we should pay some attention to this. And nobody was going to fund the research into it.
Mm-hmm.
And the government was in the middle of a depression and didn't have the money to put into primary research. And the industry certainly wasn't going to. They were all in favor of just burying it, which is what they did for the next 40, 50 years. And that's why they're being sued by people. Although Bill Frist wants to put an end to that, too, and say, no, I'm sorry, you can't sue asbestos companies.
Well, I think that if you can prove that they knew and that they hid it, then the lawsuits are the right way to go.
So now we're back to government should be proactive. Government should be active because it has to be active to enforce these so-called negative rights. So they're actually positive rights.
No, I've said government should protect us against fraud. That's it. It should leave us alone. And we should have a right to sue people when they do us damage, when they
so
do
who
us
defines,
harm. That's why you
who,
need a court system. I'm not an anarchist. I don't believe in zero government. I believe that government should do one thing, and that is to protect us from fraud and violence used against us.
And when we the people decide that, you know, we'd like to have a society where there actually is some kind of a social safety net, or we'd like to have, for example, Social Security.
I think that's immoral, wrong, and should not be allowed because it involves stealing from some people in order to give to others.
But you don't think it's immoral and wrong that there be people who are dying of hunger and cold?
If people are dying of hunger and cold, they can go and ask for charity. They have that ability.
But they were doing that in the 1930s, and they were dying of hunger and cold.
But instead of asking for charity, what you're asking is to give them a gun to put to my head and to force me to help them. And I think violence generally is wrong.
So your assertion is that taxation is violence.
What's that?
Your assertion then is that taxation is violence.
Taxation is violence. Welfare, any redistribution of wealth is violence. Absolutely.
Because it's ultimately, yeah. And I would say, yeah, okay, I'll give you that. And that's the price that you pay for admission to a civilized society. Ultimately, obviously, tax laws have to be enforced somehow. I mean, you want to have them put a gun to your head to pay for the military, right?
No, I'd be happy.
Oh, you think taxes should be voluntary?
I'd be happy to pay for the military voluntarily. I don't need a gun placed on my head to do that.
But what about me? What if I don't want to pay for your military or your police?
Then you'll be a free rider. I mean, I can tolerate a few free riders in society. I actually believe that American people are incredibly generous and rational.
You are an anarchist.
Absolutely. And would easily pay for those, plus enough charity to keep people from starving.
We'll be back with your calls. 27 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. You're on, Brooke. Ayn Rand.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Welcome back, my friends. 25 and a half minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you on the True People's Radio. We're talking with Yaron Brook, who is the executive director of the Ayn Rand Institute. And Yaron, here, one such case, Sumner Simpson. It took 70 years for this document to come out. It didn't come out until after this guy was dead. President of Asbestos Manhattan. He wrote to Vandiver Brown, heads of Johns Manville's legal department, in 1935. Quote, I think the less said about asbestos, the better off we are. Brown replied, quote, I quite agree with you that our interests are best served by having asbestosis and other asbestos-related diseases receive the minimum amount of publicity. In 1936, the asbestos manufacturing companies met in New York secretly to finance animal experiments at the Trudeau Foundation's Saranac Laboratory in Saranac, New York. They were hoping to find that asbestos didn't cause disease. They did find that it actually caused cancer. In the final report, all mention of cancer was erased. In addition, the revised report was silent in its criticism of the asbestos dust threshold limit that previously published studies had linked asbestos to cancer. Later in 1952, discussions from a Saranac symposium that included asbestosis and cancer caused by asbestosis were never published. This sworn secrecy in the asbestosis industry is also shown elsewhere. In 1947, the Asbestos Textile Foundation, the ATI, sponsored a study of textile factory workers, discovered that they were dying of cancer, refused to publish the study, hid it. Here we have, in your world, Yaron, when industry conspires to screw us at the gas pump or to kill us in the workplace, we have a recourse. We can sue them for fraud 70 years later.
Well, but in the world that you would have us live in, we would not have any of the advancement that we have today. Government has not protected us from any of this stuff. So activist government, regulatory government has not protected us from this stuff.
Au contraire. The only reason that there's not asbestos right now in half our products is because the government stepped in and said no.
Because people started dying and getting the disease, so nobody could hide it anymore. If
people were dying back in the 1930s, it was the efforts of government that uncovered this stuff.
No, it wasn't. It was the efforts of lawyers and victims that uncovered this stuff. No government regulatory agency uncovered this stuff. It was during the 1980s when this finally came to lawsuit. There wasn't a government action that drove the asbestos companies into bankruptcy. It was.
They're using bankruptcy so that they don't have to pay people off. I mean, you got Halliburton, one of the biggest purveyors of asbestos after they acquired Dresser Industries. You know, you're trying to use bankruptcy to simply avoid paying people off. We can go around in circles about this all day long. Let's bring some of our listeners into this, okay? Sure. Thomas in St. Louis, Missouri. Hey, Thomas, you're live with me, and you're on Brooke.
Yes, I have a question for Mr. Brooks. He used the terminology that the CEOs and capitalism creates wealth. I don't understand his definition of this creating wealth. My thought on it is, you know, matter's neither created nor destroyed in my scientific mind. What's he mean by creating
wealth? Well, and let me add to that, Thomas. I thought that wealth was created by the efforts of people, which by and large is the workers, or by the conversion of natural resources. And in the case of oil, frankly, I think that the oil under the ground of the United States should belong to the United States. It shouldn't be being given free to the oil companies. You're on?
Well, my thought about it is, if we're talking about wealth is my hour of labor that we the people produce, or we produce a service, or we create this, or whatever, however terminology, and I trade my hour for somebody else's hour, and we can, the financial part of that, how much I want to trade is how much we the people desire somebody else's product.
Here, Thomas, this is where we get to the nub of it. And you're on, you know, take a shot at this. Good luck.
Oh, absolutely.
A corporation is an organized institution. It's people banded together, and yet you don't think that people should be able to band together and say, we will withhold from you our labor, which is the only thing that laborers have to withhold, a strike, and that government should enforce the right to that strike.
Well, there's like five different complex questions here. First of all,
let's take them quickly. I've got a pile of callers here.
Yeah, I know. Well, the Marxist nonsense about labor creating wealth and capitalist and management.
No, it was Lincoln who said that.
Being exploiters. Has been rebuffed by many, many economists.
Right, it was Abraham Lincoln who said that. He said labor precedes capital.
Wrong.
You can't have capital without labor.
It does not create wealth. The labor theory of value is wrong. It's been proved wrong over and over again. Wealth, the most of the wealth, the largest percentage of the wealth is created by the capitalist and by the manager who organizes labor, who create labor. Labor doesn't exist without the CEO and without
the capitalist. workers are like stupid, and they need to be herded together by these brilliant capitalists, otherwise they can't produce wealth.
They need to be traded. They need to be organized. They need somebody to manage their efforts, because otherwise they stay in the farm and they subsistence farmers and they die of starvation.
You realize you're putting forward.
The industry is created by entrepreneurs, by managers, and by capitalists, not by labor. And that's where wealth is created.
You realize you're getting redundant. You realize, Yaron, that what you're suggesting is absolutely consistent with Edmund Burke's classic enunciation of conservative philosophy in the 1790s, that there has to be a ruling elite, because the masses, if they're allowed to run things themselves, will always screw it up.
No,
and that ruling elite should be economic in its basis.
No, I don't agree with that at all. I don't think we're talking about a ruling elite. We're talking about a voluntary transaction in which corporations are put together and in which labor and managers interact in a voluntary basis in order to create wealth. But most of that wealth, most of the contribution, is added through engineers and scientists and managers and capitalists who have the rare talents, because they are the exception. They are the rarity, have the rare talents that
we've got
compensation.
We've got to keep it a little shorter and tighter here. Mike in Vero Beach, Florida. Hey, Mike.
All right. Enron wanted to build a pipeline through Florida. Enron has to go to FERC, Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. To do this, they have to give an environmental impact statement, which they hire their own scientists, their agrologists, all kinds of people to write this statement. Then they notify the people by letting us know in the Federal Registry, which no one reads, no one even knows about. Then the FERC doesn't do any investigation on the environmental impact statement. They use, by the Bible, whatever Enron gave them. It was up to us as people, as citizens, to fight this. Everything was against the people. Everything was for the corporation. The government did not represent us at all. The government only represented the corporation and what the corporation said.
So you're
I
honest.
I am listening to pure evil when I listen to you.
Well, so, I would love to see.
Okay. Let's drop the personal attacks here. But Yaron, the essential question here is, if your solution is everybody has to be a shareholder in order to have a say in how a corporation functions, it doesn't work, as our caller just pointed out.
No, sure it works. What I would like to see is government step out of corporate life and corporations get out
Just let Enron do it.
Government and the corporation. What I'd like to see is, if Enron wants to build a pipeline, they have to buy the land. They can't use eminent domain to take it away from people. They have to buy it. They have to work with people who own that land in order to put that pipeline together and not use government force in order to achieve their goals.
Dale in Everett, Washington. Hey, Dale.
Hello, Tom. Thanks for having me on. I think this is just kind of a continuation of a point that was made earlier in the week, which is that this system, according to your guest there, relies on the largesse of rich people to take care of poor people. And actually, he's skipping a step in Ayn Rand's strategy, which is that corporatists and the leaders of the economy will make sure that everybody has such a good job that there are no poor people, because that's in their best interest. Now he's just skipping that step and just going straight to just ask them for charity, and they'll help you out, because they're such good guys.
Let me just insert this.
I'm my views here. I believe that in real capitalism, if we had real freedom, there would be almost no poor people. That is, I think that everybody would have a job. Jobs would be higher paying than they are today. People would be free to negotiate their jobs. I'm saying that there are always going to be cases in which some people, bad things happen to them by accident, whatever, and they are poor, they are needy. And what I'm saying is, in those situations, they don't have a right to pull a gun and force somebody to pay for their health care or for their food. They have to ask for it. That is the context in which charity is created.
Just beg from Lee Raymond.
Most people don't need charity. Most people.
Lee Raymond, please give us some of your $400 million, will you? Because we're hungry.
Oh no!
No.
Let's pull a gun and force him.
Where the rubber meets the road, you're on. Please name one country where your system has actually worked.
Well, there is none, because my system's never been tried.
So, therefore. Now, my system has been tried a lot. My system has 170,000 years of human history behind it. If you look at egalitarian societies, aboriginal societies, tribal societies, they've been doing very well.
They've been doing horrifically. Berkeley and indeed your system is taken to its extreme and serious. You got the Soviet Union, you got Cambodia.
My system is not the Soviet Union or Cambodia.
Millions of people died.
Yeah, and that is not my system you're on, and you know that. Come on, let's be intellectually honest here. Our phone number, 1-866, hang on just a second. Our phone number, 866-440-8466. We're talking with Yaron Brook, AYNRAND.org. We'll be right back. 45.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
It's the free world here. The True People's Radio, the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 10 minutes before the hour. Welcome back, my friends. Just a quick heads up, we'll get into this in some more detail in the next hour. It just passed. The U.S. Senate unanimously an amendment to the Iraq Supplemental Spending Bill. This is amazing, unanimously, that says, this is Joe Biden's amendment, says, quote, to provide that no funds made available by Title I of this act may be available to establish permanent United States military bases in Iraq or to exercise control by the U.S. over the oil infrastructure or oil resources of Iraq, end quote. That's big news. That's big news. We're talking with Yaron Brook, AYNRAND.org, the Ayn Rand Institute. And you're on. Let's head back to the phones here. Jim in Hysteria, California. Jim?
Yeah, Tom, I am so tired of people like Bush yesterday saying this is a wake-up call. And then this guy, every time the oil industry hears, you know, their reason for wanting to drill in Alaska and Canada is because oil is now over $55 a barrel, and it's free to them. So their profits grow even more. I am just so tired of them wanting to destroy the environment, kill us. It's just sickening. And the government is doing nothing about it, just like asbestos, just like everything else, cigarettes, because they're getting paid under the table to shut up and shut us up.
You're on?
Well, what I find interesting is people complain about $3 a gallon of oil. They complain about oil prices, but when somebody offers a solution to actually bringing more supply into the picture, says prices long-term decline, so that we can continue using automobiles, they find that unfair and wrong.
Why not create less demand?
What's that?
Why not create less demand? If we were to raise CAFE standards to 39 miles per gallon, we would save 51 billion barrels of oil, which is 10 times what is estimated to be in Anwar.
If prices are high, demand will come down. I mean, demand is already coming down because prices are high.
Yeah, but it may take a generation. In the meantime, you're going to have a lot of people wiped out. We saw this coming. Jimmy Carter saw this coming and said, we need to do something about it. And Reagan bought into your philosophy and said, no, we're not going to do anything about it.
Nobody's going to be wiped out. The fact is the demand for
Tell oil that to working is, people right
most
now.
Most of the demand for oil is not for automobiles. Most of the demand for oil is for manufacturing and production and job creation in places like China and India. And that's a good thing. That means there are more products, there are more jobs, there's more wealth. It's increasing the standard of living of all of us.
No, it's not. My wife is working $5 an hour because her job was sent over to India. So she has to take a job.
But that's a good thing that the jobs are being sent over to India. The fact is that then you can buy really cheap stuff at Walmart, which ultimately leads to a higher standard of living.
I want American stuff. I'm tired of cheap stuff. It don't last.
Well, don't last. Buy something more expensive that'll last.
Where's the job where I can afford the more expensive stuff?
So there's,
I can't hear him.
I get your point, Jim, and you know, well made. Well, this is now we're getting into trade policy, which is a little far afield. Jason in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Jason, you're live with Yaron Brook.
Yes. First of all, I'd like to ask your guest. I mean, this may not have anything to do with anything, but what do you do for a living, actually? How do you earn your money? And, I mean, if I can ask, how much do you make a year?
Well, I
you can choose to
doing this, doing what we're doing right now. I earn my living for advocating for freedom, for capitalism.
Okay, and do you make like over $50,000, over $100,000 a year?
I make over $100,000 a year. Yes.
Okay. Now, that really kind of skewers your opinion, you know, in a certain direction because you don't really get the point of like what the economy, what...
Nonsense, because I used to make, I lived to a period where I made under $20,000 a year. I had two kids and a wife who, because we were new immigrants to this country, couldn't work. And, you know, and we survived, and I worked through grad school, worked hard in order to make a living so that one day I could make more money.
Right. Without personalizing this.
That is the beauty of the American system.
I'm curious, Jason, what's your point?
Okay, first of all, I basically wanted to...
Without getting into personal stuff about Iran's history, because, you know, let's stick to the issues.
Of what I really wanted to ask, which is, you know, why is it that conservatives always... seem to be so far removed from what happens in the lives of just regular, ordinary Americans, because here in Grand Rapids, I work in retail. There are so many people that I run across that are hurting. They can't afford to do, you know, a lot of the things that they normally do because their wages are not moving in enough up to be able to afford, you know, just their cost of living. And I really hate to hear when people say, the economy is booming, the economy is doing this and that, when I can see this on the ground level, that people are hurting, and they're hurting bad.
I don't think the economy is booming. I think the economy could be a lot better. Wages could be a lot higher. And I think the way to get there is not through more taxes and more government controls and more government regulations. The way to get the wages of Americans up is by freeing Americans.
Free the corporations.
We
have 30 seconds left here. I'm gonna give Tom in Minneapolis.
And wages would go up. Standard of living would go up. Our quality of life would go up. Government is a destroyer of wealth, not a creator of wealth.
Yeah. Tom in Minneapolis, we have 30 seconds, Tom.
All right, let me go for 30 seconds.
No, you can have 15 because Iran will have the last 15. Go for it.
Darn quick. Economic system is subordinate to the governance system of democracy. You keep trying to elevate capitalism, a system of individual rights. You know that's a distortion. It isn't correct. We've tried your movie. It's called Republican Great Depression. Didn't work. We liked FDR's New Deal. We the people.
Okay, let me answer. The Great Depression was not created by capitalism. It was created by government. There's plenty of evidence of that. And indeed, this country is not a democracy. It's a constitutional republic. It is a government set up to protect individual rights, not to protect the right of the majority to enslave the minority.
You're on, Brooke. We have to stop it there. Thanks for being with us. Executive Director of the Ayn Rand Institute, AYNRAND. Appreciate you being on the program and sharing with us the worldview that is shared by so many people in Washington, D.C. right now.
I wish it was, Tom. Yeah, you know that.
Okay.
But I appreciate it.
Coming up next, we're taking our country back. Sherrod Brown's going to be with us. Stick around. 57 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Harpin.
You have been listening to the Tom Harpin Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Harpin.
And welcome back, my friends. 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Harpin here with you. In the last hour, talking about the $400 million severance package from Lee Raymond. I just got a little bit of a message here from him. Thought I'd share it with you.
Come here. I'm going to eat you. I'm bigger than you. I'm higher in the food chain.
Ah, bigger than us. Higher in the food chain. Okay, I got it. Thank you very much. This is our new Exxon alert from Mike Myers' character, Fat Bastard. Yeah, there is an uncanny resemblance, but that's that falls into the category of kind of private or personal attacks that I'm just not going to go there. Oh, I already went there? Okay. Well, in any case, the sex lies and government contracts, the Center for American Progress laying this stuff out. Duke Cunningham, of course, sentenced to 8 years in federal prison for $2.4 million in bribes in exchange for handing out billions of dollars, your and my dollars, to defense contractors. And, you know, you compare this to the Teapot Dome scandal in the 1920s, which was, you know, about a couple hundred thousand dollars. Albert Fell, the Secretary of the Interior, as I recall back at that time, this is so big compared to that. And yet that almost brought down the Harding administration. It's really incredible when you think about it. According to recent reports, the folks over at the Center for American Progress know, federal investigators have traced the outlines of a far more extensive network of suspected corruption involving multiple members of Congress, some of the nation's highest-ranking intelligence officials. Bribery attempts, including free limousine service, free stays at hotel suites at the Watergate and Westin Grand, and free prostitutes. Tens of millions of dollars in federal contracts awarded under dubious circumstances, and even efforts to influence U.S. national security policy by subverting Democratic oversight, small d Democratic. And who's the ringleader? The guy at the center of this is a fellow by the name of Brent Wilkes, also known as co-conspirator number one. Pardon the sneeze there. Co-conspirator one in government documents who gave more than $630,000 in cash and favors to Cunningham for helping to land millions of dollars in federal contracts. He devoted much of his 20-year career, that's the Center for American Progress, to developing political contacts in Washington, a task at which he excelled, serving recently both as, I know this is going to shock you, this particularly those of you who are listening in California, that the guy who was like the briber-in-chief of Randy Cunningham most recently served as the county finance co-chairman of Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger's campaign and as the state finance co-chairman for President George W. Bush. What a surprise. Who would have thought? Yeah, Wilkes, his family members, and his employees were heavy campaign contributors to several members of Congress, and he frequently invited members, including Cunningham, Tom DeLay, and House Speaker Denny Hastert on corporate chartered jets. And he did well. Wilkes won tens of millions of dollars worth of defense contracts for his companies through the process of closed-door congressional earmarking of the federal budget. Indeed, many of the contracts Wilkes secured were for products the Pentagon never even requested. Wilkes has thus far avoided any criminal charges, but federal officials are investigating instances of quid pro quo, since the timing of his political contributions seems to parallel the approval of earmarks for his companies. Now, interestingly enough, we're hearing reports that there's similar stuff, by the way, going on with the campaign of Catherine Harris. Yes, Catherine Harris. No, I kid you not. It's like once they get into being corrupt politicians, there's just no going away from it. The Orlando Sentinel today reports that former senior members of Congresswoman Catherine Harris's congressional staff. This is her staff ratting her out. They say Mitchell Wade, he's another corrupt defense contractor. He had asked for a $10 million appropriation request last year. They said, no, don't do it. Catherine Harris came in and instructed them to approve it. Why? Because he took her out to one of Washington's most expensive restaurants and dropped $2,800 on dinner. That's got to be a hell of a bottle of wine. I don't think there's anything else on the menu that could drive it up like that. In fact, maybe several of them. That's incredible. This Jim Stratton, the Sentinel, the Orlando Sentinel, former senior members of U.S. Representative Catherine Harris's congressional staff say they initially rejected a defense contractor's $10 million appropriation request last year, but reversed course after being instructed by Harris to approve it. Harris insisted that Mitchell Wade's request for funding be given to Defense Appropriations Subcommittee, despite the request being late and difficult to understand, according to two former staff members and Harris's former political chief strategist. An ex-staffer who was involved in the process said, she said, it's important to me, so submit it. She wanted it in. Wade is the contractor at the center of a congressional bribery scandal that's landed a California lawmaker in prison. Yeah, back to that. All the whole quid pro quo thing. For more than a decade, Wilkes, we're talking now back, you know, this cabal of bribers and corruptors of Congress. Wilkes, for more than a decade, was currying favor with lawmakers and CIA officials by hosting weekly parties at lavish hospitality suites at the Watergate and Westin hotels in Washington, D.C. Guests would gamble, socialize, and sometimes receive prostitutes. According to Harper's Magazine, the festivities began early with poker games and degenerated into what one source described as a frat party scene, real bacchanals. And I would add that Dusty Fago, the number three guy at the CIA, admits that he's been to these parties, although he doesn't recall any prostitutes. We'll get to him in just a second. Mitchell Wade, another contractor, this is the guy that we were just talking about with regard to Catherine Harris. Mitchell Wade, who pleaded guilty in February to bribing Cunningham, has told federal prosecutors he periodically helped arrange for a prostitute for Cunningham, but investigators are digging for more. FBI agents have fanned out across Washington, interviewing women from escort services, potential witnesses, and others who may have been involved in the arrangement, attempting to determine whether any members of Congress or their staffs may also have used the same free services. Last week, a reporter for the San Diego Union-Tribune said that as many as a half dozen other congressmen may ultimately be implicated in the scandal. Several have already denied ever attending Wilkes parties. Also, investigators are reportedly trying to determine whether Cunningham and other legislators brought prostitutes to the hotels or prostitutes were provided for them there. There's speculation that Wilkes may be subject to felony federal sex trafficking charges if the Virginia-based limousine service he used transported the prostitutes into Washington, D.C. Now, this is interesting. Transporting prostitutes across state lines, right? Meanwhile, the highest-ranking CIA official to admit he attended the poker parties is Dusty Fago, although a lot of people are scratching their head wondering about the other former member of Congress, Porter Goss. But nothing specifically pointing to Goss yet. Fago's relationship with Wilkes goes back 30-plus years. The two were roommates in college, best men at each other's weddings, and even named their sons after each other. The number three guy at the CIA and the guy who was supplying prostitutes to Duke Cunningham. That's who we're talking about here. By the 1980s, Fago had joined the CIA and was sent to Honduras to assist the Nicaraguan Contra rebels. I bet he gets along just fine with Death Squad John. Where his position was essentially a contracting officer, he could get anything they needed. Meanwhile, Wilkes had established himself in Washington and made his living ferrying congressmen to Central America, where he'd introduced them to Fago and the Contras. These guys go back to the Reagan administration. All things evil go back to the Reagan administration. It is increasingly becoming so obvious. The Reagan-Bush administration, 8 years corrupting this country, bringing down government, reversing the fine efforts of the New Deal, trying as aggressively as they can, in fact, to roll back Franklin Roosevelt. You'll recall that there was a member of the United States Senate who stood up and said, what about war profiteering during World War II? We want to investigate Franklin Roosevelt and war profiteering. His name? Harry Truman. What did Franklin Roosevelt do? He made him vice president.
Roosevelt is dead. His policies may live on, but we're in the process of doing something about that as well.
Yeah, one of his policies, reward people who look into government corruption. Now, we've got to do something about that as well. 16 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Harpin.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Just another poor boy out to find a rich man's boy. Buy me an eagle and a flag tattooed on his arm. Red, white, and blue, long will land in Kansas. Left behind a pretty young wife and a baby girl. stack overdue bills and went off to save the world. It's been a year now, he's still there, chasing ghosts and thunder. Meanwhile, back at home, the fine has come and took his car. Just another poor boy off to find a rich man's boy.
And welcome back, my friends. 22 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number, toll-free nationwide. If you'd like to drop into the live chat room, go to TomHartman.com and click live chat. Victoria Jones is with us with the Talk Radio News Service, TalkRadioNews.com in Washington, D.C. Victoria Jones, we got a special audio alert here this morning from the outgoing Exxon chairman, Lee Raymond. Don't know if you'd like to hear it.
I absolutely would.
Here you go.
Come here. I'm going to eat you. I'm bigger than you. I'm higher in the food chain.
I assume you saw the Mike Myers movies?
Yeah.
Yeah. Fat bastard.
Oh, yeah.
I'm going to eat you. I'm higher than you in the food chain.
I like it.
I'm sorry. I'm like a little kid with a toy here. This is such a great... So what's happening in Washington, D.C.?
What we have in Washington, D.C. is I asked Scott McClellan a question on an issue he'd never heard about before. So that's unusual.
Yeah, that is.
It is unusual. Generally speaking, if you're going to do that, you give him a day's notice. But I assumed he would know about this.
And so what was it?
It was, well, Elizabeth Dole, as you may know, is head of the National Republican Senatorial Committee.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the committee that's to ensure that the Republican senators keep the Senate, damn it.
Right.
So she sent out a fundraising email fairly recently, and in her pitch she says, quote, if Democrats take control of the Senate in 06, they will cancel the Bush tax cuts, allow liberal activist judges to run our courts, and undermine all Republican efforts to win the war on terror.
Right.
Even worse, she goes on, they will call for endless congressional investigations and possibly call for the impeachment of President Bush. So I simply asked whether, first of all, I wanted a reaction, but I wanted to know whether he really thought that an endless congressional investigation would be worse, in fact, than losing the war on terror.
Oh, that's interesting, because she said that the endless congressional investigations would be even worse than losing the war on terror.
Yeah.
Amazing. And that he was slack-jawed.
He was not a happy boy.
Yeah. Oh, boy. Wait until that meme gets out there. Now, I expect that I will see you on Keith Olbermann tonight.
Oh, I do hope not. It doesn't do me any good.
I always love it when I see you on Keith Olbermann.
How often does it happen?
Oh, it's, you know, there was a couple of months there where you were on two, three times over a period of a couple of weeks.
Really?
Some regular. Yeah, you didn't know that?
Hang on. If you'd like to cover the event in the East Room, this will be the final call.
Have to go?
No, I'm not covering the event in the East Room. Thank you very much.
Okay.
No, it's a boring event in the East Room.
Okay. In any case, what's going on in Washington, D.C.? What else is going on in Washington, D.C. today besides Scott being caught flat-footed and slack-jawed?
Yes, which is always an exciting thing to see. Well, I mean, basically, we're still all trying to react, quite honestly, to the Moussaoui sentencing. There's movement by the Republicans to try and say that they support the sentencing, which they really don't at all, quite frankly, but at the same time say that they don't like the result, which is difficult to do.
The thing that baffles me, Victoria Jones, is why have the Democrats not pointed out that while Moussaoui could have stopped 9/11 with the knowledge that he had and was rightly held accountable for that the administration had information that could have stopped 9/11 as well. You had Colleen Lowley out there jumping up and down, raising her hand in the air, and George W. Bush and Condi Rice and Dick Cheney didn't do a damn thing to stop this. In fact, they actively suppressed the people who were saying, hey, there's a problem. They didn't harden the cockpit doors. They didn't put air marshals on the planes, and yet they knew that there was a hijacked threat. Why are the Democrats not pointing this out?
I'll tell you why. It's because they're afraid that if they do it the same day that he's sentenced, they will be seen as being weak on the war on terrorism and supporting Moussaoui. If they wait a week or so, then they can say it. But right now, politically, I'm not saying that this is right. I'm just telling you, politically, it doesn't play well.
But if they wait a week or so, the topic will have changed. I think that they should be doing jujitsu. I think that they should be taking the public outrage that directed against Moussaoui and grabbing hold of it and pulling it right past them and keep it flying in the other direction right into the face of the Republicans.
You see, politically, what you're saying is counterintuitive, but I think that it's a counterintuitive time in Washington, and I think that that could work because everything else that the Democrats have done has not worked. Every time they've tried to play it safe, it has not worked for them.
Yeah, and it will continue not to. I think that they just need to start speaking truth and stop reading the polls.
But, I think you're right. By the way, the Senate passed the $109 billion measure to fund the war in Iraq and cover the cost of hurricane assistance for the Gulf.
And in that, they said no more money for permanent bases.
Good.
Pretty amazing. Victoria Jones, TalkRadioNews.com. It's 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
And I'm taking my country back. Son, you ain't been doing her right. Oh, I've been watching you and I don't like how you've been treating my stars and stripes. You took our jobs and sent them overseas. Now we owe billions to the red Chinese. The budget and you bossed Iraq, so I'm taking my country back.
Some months ago, you'll recall, we asked Bernie Sanders, who's a regular on this program, has been every Friday for going on 3 years now, how we could best support progressive candidates. Should we be giving money to the DNCC, to the DLC, to the DNC, to the... How do we get active? What do we do? And he said, find individual candidates. Find individual candidates, highlight them, get people to support them individually, go to their websites, give them money, get behind them. And so we're doing a regular feature here, finding some of the finest progressive candidates out there in the United States, our Taking Your Country Back segment.
You ain't been doing her right. Well, I've been watching you and I don't like how you've been treating my...
Because we got to take it back. These guys are not treating our country well.
Got too many fancy friends for me. The Saudis treat you like you're royalty. You blew the budget and you bossed Iraq. Now I'm taking my country back.
And taking back the United States Senate, one person at a time here. Sherrod Brown with us running. He's currently a congressman for Ohio's 13th district. He's running against Mike DeWine, one of the more notable Republican weasels in the United States Senate, running as a Democrat. Sherrod Brown, welcome to the program.
Thanks. Good to be with you, Tom.
Great to have you here with us. First of all, there were just elections, you know, before we get into the details of your agenda and program, we just had an election in Ohio last week.
Right.
As if my reading and recollection of the news is correct.
It is.
A lot of concerns. I mean, I've read John Conyers' book. What happened? How did is the election system? Is the electoral system in the state of Ohio reliable?
We're going to make it reliable. I don't know if it was reliable 2 years ago. It's clear that the Republicans did some things they shouldn't have done. It's clear that. Kerry lost it by 118,000 votes. Clearly, Ken Blackwell, the Secretary of State, did some things, at least on the edges, that cost us lots and lots of votes. Whether Kerry won the election, I don't think anybody really knows. But it's pretty clear that Ken Blackwell, as Secretary of State now, is his sort of lost his ability to run the office. I mean, he doesn't really care much about running honest elections, and he's always been running for some higher office, and he's always been angling for something else when he was Bush's campaign chair, and now when he's their candidate for governor.
And he's running for he's running for governor now.
Right.
We're talking with Sherrod Brown. His website Sherrod Brown, SherrodBrown.com. And check it out. You can contribute money there. You can contribute help wherever you may be in the United States. These are national issues. The just getting back control of the Senate and the House of Representatives, this is a national issue. Sherrod Brown, what's your take on our economy? We've got the Republicans out there saying manufacturing orders are up 4%. Things are going great. It's wonderful out there. It's morning in America.
Yeah, it's a great economy if you own it. It's a great economy for the CEO of Exxon, who makes $18,000 an hour, while the minimum wage worker in Akron, Ohio, makes less than $11,000 a year. The other night, I mean, the way to really look at this is it's clear that the people on top are doing very well, but the anxiety that workers feel about pensions, about health care, about the prospects of having a job, and about the stagnation of their wages is very real. The other night, I was in Southeast Ohio walking a picket line actually, it wasn't even a picket line because the workers weren't on strike. These are workers making $12, $13 an hour in a very profitable manufacturing plant. They were workers that were locked out. When the contract ended, the company just said, no, we're not interested anymore. This is a company, Meridian, out of Detroit or out of Michigan somewhere, and they have seven or eight plants, I believe, around the world, most of them in the U.S. This is the only union plant they have. This is steel workers. And they've brought in scabs. They want to bust the union. And these are workers, as I said, making $12, $13 an hour. I talked to one woman who's got two kids, one kid in college, one about to go to college. She and her husband both work there. They've been able to pay their tuition for their kid, not ask for any government assistance. They're screwed. I mean, if this company doesn't come back to the table, they keep these scabs in here, these workers just can't survive. And it's that story everywhere, where they're taking away their pensions, they're taking away their health care, they're in many cases taking away their jobs, and these people have no voice. They just simply, what are they going to do?
Yeah. But, you know, the cons would say, hey, we're at the top of the food chain.
Yeah, people at the top of the food chain. I mean, you look at the guy from United Health. He walked away with $1 billion-plus benefit package, a retirement package. At his board, there were all kinds of shareholders that came and said, wait a second, to the board. I'm at their meeting this week. Mm-hmm. And the board, all who make lots and lots of money sitting in these corporate boards, they all said, this is okay. This retirement package is okay. The CEO of Pfizer walked away with $85 million pension and benefit package with his retirement. His company, in the 6 years he's run the company, has dropped 44% in value. I mean, it doesn't matter if they achieve or if they're effective. They still get their bonuses and still get these incredible settlements.
It's really an old boy network. It seems in many ways, Sherrod Brown, that we're back to what the Republican Roosevelt, Teddy Roosevelt, was talking about when he talked about a new landed aristocracy emerging in the United States, a new corporate elite, and that it was threatening the very foundations of Republican government.
Yeah, we're gonna, I mean, when you see what's happened, you know, a few people are getting incredibly rich, a lot of people are dropping out of the middle class. I mean, we're gonna look like Brazil. I mean, we're gonna be a country Brazil's way more affluent than
actually, Brazil's coming back now.
Brazil's actually doing better. That's probably the wrong country to use as an example, but, you know, so many developing countries have a small sliver at the top that are incredibly rich, and then a whole lot of poor people, and
yeah,
that's what we're doing. We're not close to that yet, but that's the direction we're moving in.
Well, here's an economic example that hopefully I'm handing you a segue on this as well. When Harry Truman helped rewrite the constitutions for Germany and Japan, he had been an advocate, of course, for national health care and strong unionization, things like that, and so he wrote those things into those constitutions. The cons have been going nuts for 50 years about this, and they wanted a test case where they could prove that their conservative economic theories actually worked. So when we took over Iraq, one of the first things Paul Bremer did when he went in and you know, changed the Constitution, a flat tax, 15%, it made it so that corporations, there were no limits on the movement of capital in and out of the country. Corporations could expatriate 100% of profits. No tariffs. It was a corporate free trade zone. Contractors could bring in outside labor. They could bring in, you know, there's no concept of illegal immigrants there. They could bring in anybody they want to work for whatever pay they can get them. And the consequence of this has been a disaster in Iraq.
I'm shocked that you would think that the people in the administration would want to use Iraq that way. I mean, it's exactly right. I mean, you left out the Halliburton contracts and some of that. I mean, on issue after issue, Iraq has been sort of their testing ground for all their economic theories that haven't worked anywhere else. I mean, they haven't worked in our country when our country was way more prosperous when we thought about the Henry Ford concept that every worker shares in the wealth they create. That's what unions do. They extract wealth from the people that they create wealth for. They extract some of that wealth and share it so that the company prospers and the individuals prosper, and then the individuals else can buy the products that they make. And, you know, you can, when during the, after the NAFTA debate, I went to Mexico and went to a couple of, I went to an auto plant, GM plant in Mexico. And the GM plant in Mexico looks just like a GM plant in Lordstown, Ohio, except it's newer. The floors are clean, the workers are productive, the technology's modern. The difference between the GM plant in Mexico and one in Lordstown, Ohio, is that the GM plant in Mexico had no parking lot because the workers couldn't afford to buy the cars they make. And you can go all over the world. You can go to Costa Rica, and the workers at the Disney plants can't afford to buy the toys for their kids they make. Or you can go to a Nike plant in China, and the workers can't afford to buy the shoes they make. And the reason our country's been so successful is that workers are shared in the wealth they create. And that's the assault that the far right and the corporatists and the Republic, that run the Republican Party, the Tom DeLays of the world, that's their assault on our middle class, our family values, our standard of living, is that too many Americans are losing that ability to bargain collectively and therefore are not sharing in the wealth they create.
Yeah, they say, we should be able to organize together in the form of a corporation.
Yeah, right.
But if our workers want to organize together in the form of a union, no,
yeah, that's right.
ain't going to happen. We're talking with Congressman Sherrod Brown, SHERRODBROWN.com, his website. Please check it out. And Sherrod Brown is running against Mike DeWine for the United States Senate from the great state of Ohio. Sherrod Brown, we have about a minute and a half left. Your take on Iraq, we talked briefly about Iraq, but the military situation, the future of Iraq.
Well, it's more of the same. Condoleezza Rice says we're going to be there 10 more years, perhaps. George Bush said it's up to the next president. We keep building bases there. Nothing's improving. We need to set a winning exit strategy with timetable of withdrawal and be out and redeploy and then ultimately bring our troops home within a year and a half or so. It's simply not working. Anything that they're doing, it's making us less safe. It's dividing our country. It's killing our young people and too many Iraqis. And it's costing us $1.5 billion a week. There's nothing about this effort that makes sense, if it ever did. I mean, I voted no at the beginning, as did Bernie and Sanders and many others. But if it ever made sense, it certainly doesn't make sense now.
And yet we're building a city within a city there, the embassy.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we can't come up with the money to build the clinics that Halliburton, that these companies were contracted with, but we've done a great job building this huge, huge, huge secure embassy.
It's a disaster. Sherrod Brown, please check out his website, contribute to his campaign, help out if you can. Sherrod Brown running for the United States Senate against Mike DeWine from Ohio, a good man. SHERROD Brown.com. Sherrod Brown, thanks for being with us.
Tom, thank you. Thanks for having Bernie Sanders on all the time.
Oh, yeah, Bernie and I go way back.
The Senate together.
He's a good man.
Thank you.
45 minutes past the hour is the Tom Hartman program, Viagra for your brain.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
If you want it, here it is. Come and get it. Make your mind up fast. If you want it, anytime, I can give it. But you better hurry, cause it may not last.
We're talking about oil here, I assume. Welcome back, my friends. 10 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Well, another one just came in. First quarter profits for Royal Dutch Shell, the world's third largest oil company, $6.89 billion.
Come here, I'm going to eat you. I'm bigger than you. I'm higher in the food chain.
Lee Raymond, you got to just stay out of my computer here. Yesterday, I received I thought it was a fairly thoughtful and interesting insight into the profits of oil. This from a listener. She says, do you realize that if the profit of the oil companies are declaring is for the quarter ending March 31st, so if Exxon earned $13 billion for the quarter, their total for the whole year would be $52 billion. Assuming there are four other companies earning about the same, and we just heard Royal Dutch Shell, you know, doing very well, thank you very much. That would be profits of around $200 billion for all of them, a very conservative estimate. Now, estimating the gas users as half the population of the U.S., that's 150 million people who drive. Because, you know, there's children and there's people who don't drive and elderly and all that stuff. So 150 million car owners, more or less. You divide 150 million people into $208 billion in profits, and it's $1,387 per person in the United States per year just in profits for the oil companies. Now, those profits, by the way, were when gas was at $50 a barrel, because we're looking at the last quarter's revenues. Now it's going up 40% to $70 a barrel. So if they maintain their same percentage of profit, we're going to be paying over $2,000 a year in profits for the oil companies. At some point, you just go, whoa, you know, my eyes are starting to cross. It's mind-boggling. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Jake in Arcata, California. Hey, Jake, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
I'm great, but I'll get better.
Hey, you know these self-righteous Republicans and their hypocrisy, it's just truly stunning. I mean, look at these guys. You got Randy Duke Cunningham, Bob Ney, Tom DeLay. I haven't seen anything like this since the days of Jim Baker and Jimmy Swaggart. I mean, you know, these holier-than-thou Republicans want to tell everybody else how to handle their personal lives, and these bunch in Washington are about the most corrupt group of politicians I've ever seen.
I'm not disagreeing with you. I think that we would have to go back to the Harding administration to find anything close, you know, and as I said, you know, Albert Fell and the Teapot Dome scandal was just small potatoes. Actually, I'd say you'd have to go back to the Ulysses S. Grant administration, where Grant was involved in the railroad bribery scandals, and he was so corrupt, his administration anyway. Actually, a lot of folks don't think that he himself was corrupt. He was just ignorant of what was going on. He was a good military man and a lousy politician. But his administration was so corrupt that when he wanted to run for a third term, his own Republican Party refused to do it.
That's right, Tom. I mean, and look what we have. We basically have a new era of robber barons with these Republicans. And Lee Raymond, hey, he's a dead ringer for Fat Bastard. I love that sound.
Yeah.
Keep it up.
It really is spooky, isn't it? Thanks a lot, Jake. Good to hear from you. Tim in Oak Ridge, Tennessee. Hey, Tim, what's on your mind today?
Well, I read your book on equal protection.
Unequal protection.
How the WTO fast-track thing got into existence.
Yes.
And through that, I failed to understand in that how you can bypass the constitutional requirement for two-thirds Senate vote. Did they actually get that vote somewhere in that process?
You know, I'd have to go back and look at the history of it. I'm not sure. I believe, though, that what had happened was that the president had that a law had been passed that was associated with the presidential fast-track authority consideration that said that treaties that had to do with trade could be passed with a simple majority instead of a two-thirds vote.
What?
But I may be wrong.
The Constitution?
Well, it does and it doesn't, because, you know, the Constitution says that, you know, treaties require a two-thirds vote in the Senate and that treaties become the law of the land, but the Constitution also says that, well, it says, you know, the Congress has the right to make laws. It doesn't say that Congress has the rights to make laws that are unconstitutional. You may have a very good point there, Tim.
Well, I was struggling with that. Second question, how do we get out of can we just have an ordinary vote that is in the direction of getting out of the WTO?
It doesn't even take a vote. It just takes a president. It doesn't even take a vote. You know, we were the anti-ballistic missile treaty, for example, the ABM treaty. That was a treaty that was actually voted on by a two-thirds majority of Congress back in the days of, boy, way back. I think maybe it was even Nixon or something. I'm not sure. It's some time ago. And Bill Clinton had gotten the thing re-ratified. George W. Bush just said, we're just going to walk away from this. We're going to unsign it. So what Bush has taught us is that we can simply walk away from treaties.
Yeah.
Now, we've walked away from the Kyoto Treaty. Clinton had signed the Kyoto Treaty. Bush says, no, we're not going to do that. We're going to walk away from that.
Well, this WTO thing looks awful to me. I don't know how anybody with good sense could have gotten into it.
It is what the conservatives have been complaining for 60 years, for 80 years, really, that the UN is. And I disagree with them on this, but their point is that by joining the United Nations and signing the treaties necessary to become a member of the United Nations, we have given up some of our sovereignty. In other words, we've given other nations some power over us. And there's some small amount of truth to that with regards to war and peace. But with WTO, we have given up our economic sovereignty. We've given other nations absolute control over our economic destiny. And you're absolutely right. It's wrong, number one. It may be unconstitutional the way it was put in place. And I'm looking into that, Tim. I appreciate it. And And it's something that is devastating this country to the benefit, to the absolute benefit of the multinational corporations of the world. The book that I wrote, by the way, that Tim was talking about, Unequal Protection, The Rise of Corporate Dominance and the Theft of Human Rights, just to shamelessly plug my own book. It's actually, I strongly encourage you to read it because it's a pretty good summary of all these issues if you want some good ammunition for the water cooler wars. It's 57 minutes past the hour. Next, the latest in electronic voting disasters with Brad Friedman. We'll be right back.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. The place where reason is our lifestyle choice, the Tom Hartman Radio Program, your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. Brad Friedman is with us. He runs bradblog.com, and he's one of the... He has taken upon himself, shall we say, the job of being one of our finer chroniclers of the ongoing slow motion disaster known as electronic voting in the United States. Brad, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Tom. It's not that slow motion anymore, and I will give up being that lone voice if anybody else wants to take over the job.
Yeah, well, there's some good folks out there. You know, Lynn Landis and over at Black Box Voting as well. You've got what's her name? I just drew a blank. You know,
in truth,
Beth Harris.
Beth Harris, Bob Petraeus over at Free Press. There actually are a lot of folks working on this. I just wish to heck it was more of the national media doing this job instead of,
Well, and you do a great job of pulling it together and spamming it out. I appreciate that. Let's just take some of these things one by one. I'm just going to toss these to you, and you can tell us the story, okay? Democracy crumbling. New electronic voter registration database rejects 43% of new Los Angeles voter applications, 26% of new voter applications rejected statewide in California. Why?
It turns out that as of January 1, Bruce McPherson, the Secretary of State out here in California, has implemented a new voter registration system that forces an exact match with records from the Bureau of Motor Vehicles. So if I have my driver's license as Bradley Friedman, but I'm registered as Brad Friedman, I will be thrown out of the registration system, rejected.
Or if your driver's license says Bradley John and your voter registration is Bradley J. Friedman, then wow, that's incredible.
Yep. And
so you literally have to read your driver's license as you're filling. Because I'll tell you, Brad, if you were to ask me right now, if my middle name is spelled out on my driver's license or if it's just my middle initial, I honestly don't know.
Oh, yeah, and it's not, it's also your street address. If you wrote, Smith Avenue instead of Smith Ave, A-V-E, you'll also be rejected.
Or if I did or didn't put a period after A-V-E?
Yep.
Because it's a computer, after all.
Exactly right. And it's not only happening in California. It's happening in other states as well. It was happening in Ohio in 2004. And this is all part of this scheme, frankly, to throw more and more people off of the registration rolls under the notion that we have some sort of epidemic voter fraud problem, which we don't. On the other hand, we do have an election fraud problem, a very serious one, and that's where folks should be concentrating their efforts right now because it's melting down all across the country.
Yeah, and for those people who are confused as to why Republicans would be working so hard to keep people from registering to vote, let me just play this little clip from Paul Weyrich. Paul Weyrich, the architect of the Reagan Revolution, the guy who was the original direct mail guy behind Ronald Reagan, who helped create the Christian Coalition, who helped, make Jerry Falwell a millionaire, who helped build the whole infrastructure, who claims credit for Reagan's presidency and Bush Sr. and Bush Jr. since then. The godfather of the whole thing, speaking in a church to a group of Republican activists.
Now, many of our Christians
have what I call the goo-goo syndrome. Good government. They want everybody to vote. I don't want everybody to vote. Elections are not won by a majority of people. They never have been from the beginning of our country, and they are not now. As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections, quite candidly, goes up as the voting populace goes down.
There you go.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's exactly it. And
that's a 15-year-old quote, by the way.
That's amazing. I have not heard that before. And that is what is now in operation and well-funded, I might add, all across the country via this effort with this phony front group, this Republican front group called American Center for Voting Rights, and they're pushing in every single state for these very restrictive photo ID laws and registration laws in order to try to peel folks off the voting rolls. It's appalling, and it's but it's working, and that's really the concern.
Right. We find now that Ken Blackwell pushed, we thought it was, over 100,000 people off the voting rolls in Ohio in the months leading up to the 2004 election, where John Kerry supposedly lost by a little over 100,000 votes. Turns out it was over 300,000?
Yes, at least that much. And I keep trying to get to it. I've got some very interesting information, some actual Diebold emails about all of this and what they implemented just months before, in August of 2004. And this answers the reason why so many folks turned up in Ohio in 04, in places they had voted for 20 years and suddenly found they were no longer on the polls. They were no longer able to vote.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's unbelievable.
Continuing through the list here of headlines over at bradblog.org, .com, we're talking with Brad Friedman, the blogger in chief there and also, former and sometimes radio host, as you probably can tell, but just by listening to it, you got a great radio voice, Brad.
Thanks.
E-voting, the 2006, the approaching train wreck, a national disaster in the making?
Oh, indeed. And this has been going on now for weeks, if not months. And myself at bradblog.com, along with John Gideon from votersunite.org, we have been trying to connect the dots about what's going on all over the country. We've got a situation where these companies, ESNS and Diebold, the major electronic voting machine companies, have been snatching up, you know, every contract they can to get all of this free federal money that is available as of this year because of the Help America Vote Act. They're taking every contract they can, irrespective of whether they can actually service that contract. And now, in states and counties all over the country, ESNS, in particular ESNS, has been failing to meet contractual obligations. Elections, primary elections have begun. Early elections have begun in many states, and many of these states don't have voting machines. They don't have ballot programming for their electronic machines, and in many cases they don't have ballots at all to send out for absentee voting because ESNS, excuse me, requires that they create the ballot definitions. So now ESNS is being sued by states all over the country, Oregon, Pennsylvania, Texas. Secretary of State just issued an alert to the entire state of Texas. They've got a runoff coming up there, alerting them, telling them to create emergency paper ballots because they don't have them from the company, ESNS.
Brad, you're out there on the ground. Any sense of what percentage of people in America know that the guy who I've been predicting for 5 years is going to be the next Republican presidential candidate, Chuck Hagel, was the before he got elected in Nebraska as United States Senator from Nebraska, sold the machines that his company made in Nebraska to the state of Nebraska, and then the election was held on his own machines, which put him in the U.S. Senate, that he was the former head of the company that became ESNS?
Yes, that is the case. What was the question?
Do you have any sense of what percentage of Americans know that this is the Chuck Hagel was a voting machine baron?
Oh, yeah, almost nobody. I mean, certainly, they certainly don't realize that, and they don't realize in general the folks who are behind all of these companies, almost always Republican companies. The only thing that has changed is now that one of these companies, Sequoia, was purchased by a Venezuelan company. Suddenly, the Republicans out there, some of them, are saying, oh, my God, we've got a company that makes voting machines that seems to be controlled by Hugo Chavez. And now they're up in arms about private ownership of electronic voting machines.
Well, and all of a sudden, Sequoia's not doing so well in some of these contracts. ES&S and Diebold are picking up a whole lot more of them.
Well, yeah, well, Sequoia is also has plenty, but it turns out they were recently shown to be hackable in Allegheny County, Pennsylvania, and they themselves had a disastrous election in Illinois, their primary election a few weeks ago, where machines broke down all over the state. More and more disasters every time we have a Republican, a primary election here this year. We have had a meltdown, including last Tuesday.
North Carolina, 1,000 memory cards failed. Nebraska, 69 of the 93 counties, ES&S, of course, no paper ballot. 11 counties in Indiana, same problems with threatening lawsuits. Preble County, Ohio, hadn't gotten paper ballots. This Texas Secretary of State, urgent memorandum. Pennsylvania, ESS. Why aren't people screaming about this, Brad Friedman?
Well, because they seem to be reporting these stories as a local story. It's actually getting quite a bit of coverage in the local paper as if, you know, oh, this just happened today in Allegheny County, Pennsylvania.
Right.
But the national media is not jumping in and connecting the dots to report that all of these
We need to be on this, and we need to be talking to our national media. Brad Friedman, bradblog.com, 16 minutes past the hour. Brad, thanks for being with us.
Always, Tom.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
It just don't get any better than this.
No, it doesn't, my friend.
It's about as good ever gets.
There you go.
If there's anything better, it's something I miss. It just don't get any better than this.
Helping you win the water cooler wars. Tom Hartman here with you. 21 minutes past the hour. The U.S. far behind Canada, the European Union, and other countries, notes the Wall Street Journal. In what? What is it that we're far behind Canada, the European Union, and other countries in? Tracking down disease in our animals. This is absolutely spooky. This article by Scott Kilman. You'll recall some months ago that there was a case of mad cow disease down in Alabama that was confirmed. There were a couple of them in a row, and you know these were kind of one-day stories. Oh, we found a case of mad cow disease. Eh, go back to sleep. Well, today on page 6 of the Wall Street Journal, you know, buried on the inside, well, I don't know how buried, but in any case, the headline, Mad Cow Case Frustrates Officials. Government regulators closed a mad cow disease case in Alabama without learning the animal's origins. And said that their fruitless search highlights the need for a proposed national livestock identification program. A program that, gee, after England had its mad cow meltdown, what, a decade ago? Pretty much everybody in the world put into place, except us. Scott Kilman writes, federal and state officials said yesterday they spent several weeks following leads to 37 farms. Nothing. Couldn't find it. Nobody's keeping records. The 10-year-old Alabama beef cow, which was diagnosed in March and didn't enter the food chain, was breeding stock. Oh, we've been eating its offspring. And most likely contracted the disease by eating contaminated rations in the first year of its life. Kilman goes on to note, a proposed national livestock identification program is in danger of being bogged down by resistance from many rural interests. And then he says, ranging from populist ranchers and Amish farmers to organic growers and rodeo competitors. Well, it sounds nice. But I suspect it's really agribiz. And, in fact, he kind of lays it out. He says, many ranchers oppose an identification system out of fear that liability for foodborne disease might end up on their doorsteps. Well, that's not the American way to hold people responsible. He goes on to say, the U.S. is far behind Canada, the European Union, and other countries that have elaborate systems to trace sick animals in order to isolate disease outbreaks. The Alabama cow did not have any identifying marks, such as a brand or a tattoo. The Bush administration didn't put the idea of a national identification system on the front burner until after the first U.S. mad cow case of mad cow disease was discovered in December 2003 in a Washington State dairy farm. In that case, U.S. regulators were able to locate the sick animal's Alberta birthplace only because it carried an ear tag issued in Canada. Since then, notes Kilman in the Journal, fights have erupted within the major farm groups and among states over whether the system should be mandatory, who should control the data, and what sort of technology should be used. While the Agriculture Department is pushing to have a voluntary system in place by 2009, federal officials could impose mandatory rules if they deem that too few farms are participating. Oh, aren't you reassured? In 3 years, we're going to start a voluntary system. Couldn't you safely argue that we already have a voluntary system? How's it going to be any different? Well, but it's the way Bush does things. That's what he did with the chemical industry and the oil industry in Texas, you'll recall. We'll make pollution voluntary. Pollution, and what's the result? Texas is one of the most polluted states in the United States now. A disaster. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Alice in Humboldt County, California. Hey, Alice.
Hi, Tom.
Hi, Alice.
We haven't spoken for a while, but I still listen every day.
Well, thank you.
We learn much on this program. I still believe that terrible, greedy people stole our country. So I try to get you to ask any member of Congress to try to do something about the voting machines. That was a lot of news coming out this last half hour on the voting machines.
Yeah, and there's a lot more where that came from.
Oh, yes.
It's absolutely grim what's happening all across the United States. And Alice, I really appreciate your tenacity on this issue.
Yeah.
In your 92 years, do you recall when? I mean, you always voted on paper, right?
When what?
Do you recall when voting machines, when you first saw a voting machine?
Oh gosh.
Would have been in the last decade or so, right?
Oh yes.
It had to have been a novelty after.
Oh yes.
Voting on paper.
Oh, we were thrilled to death, I guess.
Yeah, at first.
Some right? dodos.
Yeah, so how back, 40, 50, 60 years ago in the United States, people voted. How long did it take to learn who won an election?
Well, it took a few days.
And democracy continued, didn't it?
Yes.
There you go.
Well, that's right.
You make a strong case for paper ballots. Alice, thank you for the call.
Okay.
It's always wonderful talking to you.
Yeah.
Thank you for listening to us there on KGOE in Eureka, California. It's 27 minutes past the hour. The place where smart people get their news. The Tom Hartman Program. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
It's all good. It's all right. Lord, it's always a good day when you're glad to be alive. Everything I need ain't too hard to find. Why don't waste my time complaining? Cause I don't see how I could. It's all
there you go, my friends. 26 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman with you. Yeah, complaining? No, doesn't work. Instead, what you want to do is you want to wake people up, you want to educate them, you want to motivate them, you want to get them out there, you want to get them active. You and them, we, us, it's what we have to be doing. By the way, interesting little bit of news. I don't know if you noticed, those of you who pay attention to the business news, which is the only kind of news you can get these days. You can't get labor news. I mean, you get news as well, sort of. You get infotainment, and we get business news. Arguably, the only really truly factual and relatively dispassionate news that we get is in the business sections of the paper. And even that, of course, is entirely skewed toward the interests of millionaires and billionaires and not that of the average working person. I remember the day, but, you know, back long ago and far away, when newspapers had a labor section as well as a business section. Or some newspapers had a labor section, other newspapers had a business section. That was before consolidation. But in any case, for those of you who follow the business news, you might have noticed yesterday that oil fell about $2 a barrel. Real significant. And that there are early indicators that the price of gasoline may actually fall over the next week. Now, in fact, here, this AFX story, Dateline Singapore. Oil prices fell in Asian trading hours after an unexpected increase in U.S. stockpiles. This was overnight. All right, this is happening in Asia at 3 o'clock in the morning while we're all asleep. An unexpected increase in U.S. stockpiles in gasoline. Gee. At 11, they say at 0350 GMT here, New York's main contract, light sweet crude for June delivery was down 23.23 USD at U.S. dollars, down 23 cents at 72.05 a barrel from its close of 72.28 New York overnight. And they discovered 2.1 million barrels of gasoline that they didn't know they had. Markets had bet on a fall of 650,000 barrels. Now, could that have something to do, the sudden discovery of, oh, we have more gasoline than we thought we did. We have more oil than we thought we did. Could it have something to do with the fact that yesterday the U.S. House of Representatives passed a bill by a 389-34 vote, by the way, that will send the executives of oil companies engaged in price gouging to jail. And since this law passed, I mean, within hours, it actually hasn't passed, it just, you know, made it through the House. As soon as this thing comes out of the House, all of a sudden, oh, gee, we have a little more oil. The day after, the chairman of ExxonMobil...
Come here, I'm going to eat you! I'm bigger than you, I'm higher in the food chain!
Out of here, Mr. Raymond, excuse me. The new chairman of ExxonMobil was on all the talk shows and whatnot saying, we're in the business to make money. Well, will you lower the price for the consumers, please? No. Doesn't matter to me how much money, you know, goes into my corporate jet, he says. Well, he didn't say that, but I think we could kind of take it. Jim in Seattle on the line. Hey, Jim, thanks for calling. What's up?
There's a couple of things, Tom. How are you doing today?
I'm great, but I'll get better, Jim. What's up?
Okay, first of all, I read an interesting op-ed the other day. It was a takeoff on an article written, The Worst President in History, by Sean Wilnitz.
Was that the piece that was in Rolling Stone?
Yes, it was.
It's the cover story in Rolling Stone this week, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, it was a very interesting story. And he didn't really take Bush on corruption or anything else as a specific, but he cited...
No, they just surveyed historians.
Yeah, how he stacked up against Buchanan and the likes of Hoover and so on and so forth.
Right.
The other thing I had to say was, you know, this administration does absolutely nothing without a plan in place to get a profit out of it. So why did they release the information the other day about a possible flu pandemic?
Well... I would hope that occasionally this administration does things because it's the right thing to do. I'm with you that they love to wave the bloody flag, you know, and say, 9/11, look out, terrorists, warning, and you know, they'll use things like illegal aliens when it suits them to they're gonna register to vote, look out, to manipulate things the way they want to manipulate them, but.
Well,
bird flu. I'm hopeful.
When traditionally does the flu season hit?
Usually, it's in the fall, isn't it?
Just about time that elections hit.
Oh yeah. Gee, what a coincidence. Well,
watch your backside.
Yeah.
Here they come again.
Yeah. Well, Jim, I hope and pray you're wrong, and. and I'm not going to argue with you about it.
I hope I am too, but I don't think so. We'll talk to you then.
Okay, thanks a lot, Jim. Yeah, let's check back in on this in November. Ray, hey Ray, what's up?
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
I know you're great, but you'll get better.
Yeah.
I just wanted to go back to the Euron thing. Wow, he really upset me.
Euron Brook, for those listeners who might have just tuned in, the first hour of our program, we had the executive director of the Ayn Rand Institute on, who is representing the school of thought that has informed not just the objectivist movement, but the libertarian movement and the modern conservative wing of the Republican Party, and even some conservatives in the Democratic Party, very, very heavily with this idea of that we should go back to laissez-faire economics. Laissez-faire economics like England had during the time of Charles Dickens, whose father, by the way, was thrown into debtor's prison, one of the reasons why Dickens so heavily emphasized poverty in so many of his books. Pardon the interruption, Ray.
That was precisely the point. My thinking was, I mean, he was saying somehow the system is pointing a gun to the rich's head and threatening them physically with their lives.
Well,
to provide money to the system.
Yeah,
my question was, isn't that what the rich are now doing to the poor?
Well,
and leaving them without the ability to take care of themselves?
Yeah, here's their logic, and it's important to understand their point of view, because if you don't understand their perspective, you can't deconstruct it. And when people get into arguments with these guys around the water cooler or at home or whatever, you know, it's if you don't really know how they're thinking and the end point, the logical end point of their thinking, it's impossible to have to actually win an argument with them or even just have a discussion. Their argument with regard to taxes, and they will always take it back to this, is that taxes are coercive by their nature because they're mandatory. In other words, you must pay taxes. If you don't pay taxes, then eventually the government will come and drag you off to jail. And it's true. I mean, you know, it's one of those things that you can't argue with. And so they drag this thing out and say, you know, taxes, you're putting a gun to my head to take my tax money. What they don't...
See, and
there is truth there, right? I mean, if you don't pay your taxes long enough, they will eventually arrest you. And when they come to arrest you, they have guns in their holsters, and they can pull them out, and they can point them at you, and they can even shoot you if you resist. So,
right. You
know, you can argue and they do argue that taxes are coercive by their nature and that they involve violence. Now, the flip side that they never talk about is that they say that the only purpose of government should be to enforce contracts. Right, and to prevent fraud and maybe put out fires, but they're not even really sure about that.
Right.
Now, let's say that, Ray, that you and I enter into a contract and that I'm going to sell you something. My company's going to sell your company something.
Mm-hmm.
And the contract doesn't work out. And you allege that the contract didn't work out because I did something in bad faith, that, mm-hmm. you know, I lied to you or something like that.
Right.
You now have the ability to prosecute me for crimes that had to do with the business, and if I lose, if it's a criminal penalty, or even if it's a civil penalty and I ultimately don't pay, it now becomes a criminal penalty, then you have the power to send the police to my home to come and get me, and there we're back to the guys with the guns again.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, their argument that taxes are coercive, you can flip around and say, well, you know, but you want to use the coercive power of government to enforce contracts? Well, yeah, but we don't want to talk about that. See,
right.
There's that, first of all. And then the second part of the libertarian, conservative, objectivist Ayn Rand argument is that in addition to taxes being coercive, that they didn't, he would say, and I don't want to put words in Yaron's mouth, but I've, you know, debated enough these guys to know what they say. They would say that, hey, I never signed on for Social Security. I don't recall, you know, at the age of 5 or 10 or 15 or 20 or whatever, saying, sure, you know, sign me up. I'll agree to pay Social Security taxes. I didn't sign up to be sure that there's a social safety net to care, you know, for welfare payments, things like this. Therefore,
right.
you know, I didn't sign this social contract. And they will always pull that thing out. I didn't sign a social contract. And the answer to that is, Hey, the
you
social,
were born in America.
That's right. The social contract is part of society. And if you don't like the social contract, leave. Nobody's holding people in the United States, at least so far.
Right, the reverse argument. If you don't like it, you can just get out.
Yeah, yeah. And then they say, oh, but, you know, you want to impose these things on me. Yes, yeah, we do want it collectively. And then you say, well, but what about democracy? And they will say, we don't believe in democracy.
We believe
in capitalism.
Would they like this country without it?
Right. Well, they think that, I mean, this is the thing. God save us from the true believers, because they really and truly believe that if there was no government, if government just completely got out of the way and there was uninvolved in any way, that the corporations and the benevolent capitalists would take care of everything. Ray, thanks for the call. 45 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Never say thank you to those who have many. Never say thank you to those who still play fair. Hallelujah, the meek shall inherit. Never say thank you to all you people out there.
And welcome back, my friends, and thank you for tuning in. Thank you for listening. Marion Delgado in our chat room. You can get to the chat room by going to TomHartman.com. Says most of us are in the FDR camp of whatever works. That's what we would do. And FDR was the ultimate pragmatist. He was not an ideologue. He was, you know, let's try a whole bunch of different things, and those that don't work, we'll stop doing them. And Marion Delgado says there's a Russian saying: if you whack the owl with the post, or if you whack the post with the owl is still dead. Typically Russian, you know, it's a Dalsha Yudish, Talsha Budish, right? Yeah, it's just Strasvidya Tavarish. Well, excuse me, I'm sorry. It's a, in any case, typically Russian kind of bummer metaphor, but it's right. You know, you do what works. And I think that, you know, we have been experimenting with democracy and a republic here in the United States for 200 and some odd years. And it should be fairly obvious, if you just look back over the history of this country, what times it was working. Gee, when did we have the golden age of the middle class? The 1940s, 50s, 60s, and 70s. And what was happening during that time? Top marginal tax rates were 90% on millionaires and billionaires on their income. There was a high inheritance tax. Wealth was more evenly distributed. Hospitals could not be for-profit corporations. Health insurance companies had to be not-for-profit corporations. The profit motive was not part of medicine. Unions had considerable power and strength. We did not have illegal immigration of any consequence into the United States. What was different then? It should just inform us. Speaking of illegal immigration, yesterday I told you about the sheriff in Maricopa County and his posse. We have another posse alert.
Move him on, hit him up, hit him up. Move him on, hit him up, rawhide. Cut him out, ride him in, let him out, cut him out. Ride him in, rawhide.
You see, this is the fantasy of the Minutemen. They think they're just going to go out there and round up illegals, right? Complete with whip. The Minutemen Project Civilian Border Patrol plan to kick off a 12-city tour. This is from Local6.com. I'm sorry, I don't know what city this is Channel 6 in. Actually, it's a reprint of an AP story, so we'll credit this to the Associated Press. Minuteman Project Civilian Border Patrol plan to kick off a 12-city tour to build support for its Get Tough Border stance in the wake of pro-immigrant rallies around the country. They're going to use this caravan. It's going to end up at Capitol Hill. The group hopes to counter the impact made by the more than 1 million illegal immigrants and their supporters who took the nation's streets earlier this week. However, a little bit of a problem. The demonstrations by the Minutemen Project on Monday were scattered and small, often numbering fewer than 100 people per city. Nonetheless, they're going to go to Crawford, Texas, and then Phoenix, and then Albuquerque, and then Abilene, Texas, Little Rock, Arkansas, Memphis, Nashville, Tennessee, Montgomery, Alabama, Atlanta, and Richmond, Virginia, and finally end up in Washington, D.C. Now, let me just say, I don't want to be putting down these Minutemen guys. I mean, it's we can, you know, play the, we will play our posse theme music. But the fact of the matter is that it's a bunch of scared white guys. And this is what the Republicans have done such a great job of manipulating over the last, well, basically ever since Ronald Reagan, is white guys by and large who are afraid of losing their jobs, or who are afraid that the women are going to take over, or who are afraid that people of other colors or other races or other religions are going to have more influence than they are, and they're basically playing on the fears of these folks. And these are those folks. These are the scared white guys. And I think rather than ridiculing them or attacking them, we should have compassion for them. We should understand, you know, they're scared for a legitimate reason. The middle class is being hollowed out. The United States is being destroyed economically. What they don't get is that the United States is not being destroyed by illegal immigrants. That's a symptom of the problem, not the problem itself. It's being destroyed by the conservative economic policies that are causing illegal immigration, both that are destroying the economy in Mexico and causing people to want to come here, and more importantly in my mind, that are saying to employers in the United States, yeah, sure, go ahead and hire illegals. It's a fine thing. And if you can't hire illegals, if you can make it in China or if you can get it done in India, that's fine too. We're all in favor of outsourcing. And so you have a whole bunch of scared white guys who, you know, once thought they, you know, put in their 30 years, get their pension, retire, and now they're toast. Sean in Sacramento, California. Hey, Sean, we have 1 minute left. What's up?
Then I'll be quick. I just wanted to talk about how you talk about that sometimes, yeah, some of these men, like the objectivists that you often have on, are kind of honest about their politics. I think it's true. I talk to a lot of conservatives. I have a very staunch Republican brother, but I have argued with him to the point where he'll say, but you know, a little fascism is a good thing.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that is the conservative. That's the bottom line for conservatives. They believe in a rule by the elites. That's why they refer to us as the liberal elites, because they're trying to take the sting out of the word.
Oh, and I agree. I think that's the thing, is that when you see many of these conservatives, what you have to understand is that they don't believe in populism. They don't believe rule by the people or a government, you know, for the people or government of the people. They really do have a sense that there should be an elite. It should run things. And they don't want to say it because they know that. And I think why they keep it hidden is that the vast majority of Americans, no matter what way, they actually believe that we are a government of the people.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, they're just scared to let on that, oh, okay, we don't want to alienate all of you.
Yeah, no, you're right. You're right, Sean, and it's well said, and I appreciate your calling in. And good point. And this is a debate, by the way, that John Adams and Thomas Jefferson were having. It's not a new one. Or Thomas Paine and Sir Edmund Burke, actually. Read Common Sense read The Rights of Man, rather, by Thomas Paine. Tomorrow, Bernie Sanders will be with us, Brunch with Bernie, and conservative Scott Hodge. He wants to do away with all taxes. I'm going to say, what do you want, a freeload on the commons? That and more in your calls right here. Remember, my friends, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.